welcome, everybody. My name is Peter Pinkasov. Today is November 29th, and this is an exchange takeover of the Daily Briefing. I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Weston Nakamura. Weston, how are you doing?
Not too bad. How are you, sir?
Good. How was your break? Everything okay?
Yeah. How was your turkey? Expensive?
Fattening, but I was going to make some analogy to how crazy the markets were because this is the first daily briefing in like 5 days, calendar days. So a lot of stuff to cover. Most importantly, let's just dive into what happened in the markets. I mean, we got a whole agenda of things. We're going to cover like the last 5 days in markets, the central land, like a piece of virtual land getting bought for $2 million, COVID variants, Turkish lira, et cetera. So a lot of stuff to cover. But let's talk about Friday, because that was a really interesting and actually kind of a monumental or historic market action day. We really haven't seen that kind of volatility in a really long time. I think market participants look at variant being the culprit behind that kind of move. What are your general thoughts about, you know, global markets here, the price action from Friday and then carrying over into today?
So equities, right? There's a general sort of, it's not a myth, it's, you know, it's a reality, but illiquidity the Friday after Thanksgiving and all that. That I believe applies to obviously the U.S. Treasury market, but I don't think that applies, not nearly as much at least, to the equity markets anymore, given the massive growth of retail participation in the markets and activity, as well as the fact that institutions are now able to trade from home. This was not the case. I mean, you know, a year ago, you know, I guess it was sort of the case, but it's that whole sort of, you know, infrastructure change. So there was, these are not holidays for Asia or Europe either. So Europe on Friday sold off on massive volume. Euro stocks, DAX, you know, the Nikkei, from futures, from close to close, futures, the Nikkei was down 5% intraday, also on massive volume. So the illiquidity thing, I don't really, you know, I don't really buy. What I think is happening is, yeah, so this variant is basically, you know, it was the spark that kind of, you know, lit the whole place on fire, but it didn't really, it wasn't because of the fact that it was, you know, pandemic related. It could have really been anything. That just so happened to be what shoved everything over the cliff. But things were kind of teetering as it was. You know, you saw volatility up as, you know, spot was on, index was coming up. I was talking to Craig Peterson from Tier 1 Alpha about that. There's a lot going on kind of setting up for that. It just that, you know, it just happened to be this one headline that obviously reversed today. So
sure. So you're saying, you know, it wasn't really illiquidity so much, because when I, as kind of a market participants, I look at that Thursday or Friday being a half day, my first reaction was, okay, yeah, you mentioned like retail is more involved in the market, right? So when I think about that, I think there's more market orders, and that's what really moves markets, right? Like the people hitting bids, lifting offers. It's a breath game. So my reaction to what you said was, I thought you were going to say that, okay, there's more high frequency activity, there's more market making activity, and they're not backing off the Friday. They're still working. They're all going to work. Is that a fair assessment as well?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Citadel algos don't really eat turkey. I don't think so. You know, I mean,
they eat all our turkeys every single day.
They do. I think that there is no more retail flow anymore, right? As long as there's pay for order flow, there's no such thing as just pure retail flow, because it comes with institutional baggage. You're not trading on the exchange. You're trading off exchange OTC against an institution. That's institutional order flow. That's being kind of that's aggregating millions of orders, one call option at a time, and you know, in aggregate, it's just like a one gigantic asset manager. And they're very much, you know, what else would they be doing? Like, of course, they're going to trade volatility on a volatile Friday. So, and I think that, yeah, and I also think that institutional active managers would probably also, if not active, they were certainly watching their screens and ready to, you know, execute orders.
Sure.
Yeah. Took the day off. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So I'm glad. So I think we're pretty much kind of in agreement to some extent about what happened on Friday. What are your thoughts in, you know, kind of, I don't want to be too short term, but maybe, you know, any broad thoughts kind of 2 days out from here? Was that a quote unquote Bible dip? Would you think that, you know, there's something actionable here from, or do you think that this volatility is just getting started?
Yeah, I think it's funny. Last time I was on with you, you said medium term, 5 days. So your time frames are hilarious. I think, all right, so let's just think about into the end of the year, right? Because this is also what contributed to it, right? S&P was up, what, 25% or whatever it was, basically in a straight line for the entire year. And so if you're, if you work in institutional finance, you're going to take profit, especially if other people are starting to take profit to close out your books before bonus season, because why not? Institutional investors don't operate on, you know, they might say like, oh yes, we have a 5-year time horizon or whatever. You work on a 12-month calendar time frame. Like that's how you are investing and divesting and all that, right? Normal people, they obviously, we're not going to just sell just because it's December or whatever. But that, you know, I think that a lot of that came in too. Like people were just like, people are very long right now. They kind of are nervously long, and then just kind of the slightest little, you know, VIX through 20 and then out. Well, maybe a lot of it's systematic too.
Yeah.
But going into the end of the year, I think that you're going to see, I think that you're probably going to see elevated volatility. And you're probably going to have swift profit taking, and it one of those times it just might not be met with dip buying.
No Santa Claus rally. That's your call for the most part.
It's Santa Claus rally, like mini rallies and mini sell offs, mini crashes. Santa Claus crash.
Okay, so like range expansion, volatile environment, basically a culmination of what we've seen over the last week and a half, maybe in a more higher frequency.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, yeah, I think that we'll probably swing in a huge range. So where it like ends on the 31st, that's the last day of trading, I don't know if it's going to be to the upside or the downside, but I think that that band of volatility is going to widen out.
And one last kind of global markets question. Do you have any view on growth or value outperforming? I mean, that's more or less a rates call, and we can talk about that when we cover Lira or whatever. But do you got any sense of which factor you think might be really strong into year end, or are you sort of agnostic across that?
I was bullish on, you know, the Nikkei, but then every single bank strategist started coming out saying that, well, we are overweight Nikkei, and now. So are they already? So then, like, now I can't be anymore. And then the Nikkei, you know, just shed 5% in a day. So I think that that's a very crowded trade, and I no longer think that it's, you know.
That's one of those seasonal trades that always works, and then when it doesn't, everybody runs for the hills. You know what I mean? Like every 5 years, like 4 out of the 5 years, that Nikkei long from October into year end is just so good. And then even last year was just incredible. And then like, as soon as I think you reversed the entire move of that breakout, and it's just been like a dead trade ever since. Yeah. Like, Toyota looked really good. Honda looked really good for a little while. Now all of them look like those charts are completely tight.
SoftBank had a 25% 3-day short squeeze. But yeah. I always say like Japan is it's the least loyal cap. It's the most disloyal capital. It's like people buy Japan not because they not out of greed. This is true FOMO. This is, if I don't participate to the upside, I'm gonna get fired. So they buy it out of fear. But it's the last thing in the portfolio, and it's the first thing out. So disloyal capital, yeah.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Well, speaking of FOMO, I think that's a good transition into a headline that I saw. It was that Decentraland, somebody bought a plot of digital land on the metaverse blockchain for $2.43 million. Now, I read that headline and it's like, I'm reminded of Toys R Us, like KB Toys stuff. But at the same time, like, I'm such a blockchain bull as well. But there are facets within blockchain that I'm just like completely surprised about. Like, I'm not too familiar with Decentraland or its utility, or maybe it's a fun thing. But what are your thoughts here on this kind of headline?
Just to be completely honest with you, and this is, of course, out of my pure ignorance, I have no idea if that's a lot or not. Like, if you throw that figure out there, and like, I don't know what to make of it. Like maybe that's a massive bargain. Like, I kind of, this is a very kind of maybe out there sort of analogy, but the first thought that actually came to mind was like Native Americans who basically, you know, sold the island of Manhattan for like $15 or whatever it was, right? They did that because they were, you know, culturally ingrained with like, you can't own land. Like, this isn't like, that's not a concept that so.
Sure, it's hard to know what you don't know. So.
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, like, I'll sell you. Yeah, go ahead. But, you know, you want to buy the sky or whatever.
You can't own land. Right.
I'm not saying that was a right thing to do, or obviously I'm not advocating, obviously. But that in that sort of same concept, like, I think that, you know, me not getting it is basically kind of the same, like, I don't have that sort of mind frame. I'm not saying that the people that are buying them are also getting a spectacular deal either.
Sure. But I think you basically just compared Decentraland buyers to colonialists, but continue.
I suppose I did, if you want to put words in my mouth, yes. But so I think that it's just a matter of it's just perception. It's the same thing. Like, so like value is all subjective, right? So, but for me, I'm so clueless as to what is, you know, genuine value or not. I mean, that's either like an insane amount of money or probably way too little.
Sure. I'm, by the way, in a very, very similar camp. What about this? What, you know, any broad crypto thoughts? I know you're talking a little bit about Mana before this. What are some things you're looking at in the crypto space?
Certain cohort of the Bitcoin community, for some reason, really despises this chart, this factual chart. But look at crude oil versus Bitcoin. That's all. Like, if you want to understand price action of Bitcoin and therefore other, you know, cryptocurrencies that move alongside. Obviously, there is some dispersion here and there, but you saw a massive sell-off in both. You saw a massive recovery in both. This is not just the last 2 days. This is ongoing. I have a chart up on like Twitter for that, but yeah. I'm always trying to find what, as it gets more and more institutionalized, I'm trying to find what is what kind of assets are correlated to it, and no, they're not always permanent. No, they're not always even like correlations or correlations. I get all that too. The one thing I will say though is Ether futures are coming in about 6 days.
Micro ones, right?
Yeah, the micro. Yeah, not the futures already exist. Yeah, so maybe that will be a turning point, or you know, a sell news point. But the last CME listed Ethereum product tend to do well, and the BTC ones tend to crash the market
pretty poorly.
So
I think the last time we talked about crypto together, Tezos was like 4.5. I was like, I love Tezos, XTZ. I think it ran all the way to 9 in the next month, and now it's all the way back to, I mean, it's up like 25% today, but here it is again. I'm looking at some of these altcoins that are really getting some pretty powerful investments into them across not only, you know, NFT spaces, but infrastructure and dApps, et cetera. I don't know. It's just, it's one of those things that I think you can make that Decentraland analogy about. It's hard to know what you don't know across a lot of these things. And that's why you have exponential growth, is because there's so much uncertainty. So anyway, maybe that's a good transition into currencies and talking about Turkish lira. But before we do that, let's play a clip from a Lynn Alden series that's on the Real Vision Pro and Plus tiers, where she covers this kind of uncertainty about currencies. So let's take a look at that.
When we're in an environment where your savings account and your checking account are yielding below the inflation rate, and where they fail to preserve your purchasing power over time, we historically started to see speculative behavior. So this is something that, you know, developed markets in many ways are encountering for the first time for, you know, a couple of generations. But when we go back in history, this is a really challenging environment for people to navigate, because the unit of account, the money that they use itself becomes questionable. And so they start, you know, monetizing other assets. And so especially in this online culture, it becomes rather funny, but it ultimately is a very serious topic. And so when I'm asked about 2022, I often think that, you know, whether or not that year turns out a certain direction, I think the bigger question is what's going to happen to the 2020s decade, because any one year might be an anomaly, especially when you have these big changes. It's never linear. It's never with low volatility. And so one year could be all the trades that worked the prior year stop working, only to start working again the next year. And so at least, you know, there's all sorts of risk management approaches for how people navigate those environments. But my main focus is on the big picture. So I think 2022, we'll see a cooling off of some of the things you've seen in 2021. Most likely, it depends on all sorts of policies that are maybe outside of our control or forecast at this moment. But I think the bigger theme long term, as we look, you know, towards the end of this decade and you know, during that process towards it, is that we're clearly having a transformation in what money is and how we interact with money, and what assets that we monetize as we kind of preserve value from one system to another.
So that was a clip from the Lynn Alden series about cryptocurrencies. I think that was a specific interview with Luke Groman, which is actually pretty fascinating. I think it's about an hour long. Again, available for Pro and Plus members. Weston, Lynn Alden talked about this idea about currencies basically losing their value and divestment and a flight to quality and safety. But Lynn, she was talking about a timeline of like 10 years out. And what I want to do was ask your thoughts about the Turkish lira, because that has rallied like 10-15%, and the volatility of 150% in, I don't know, like 3 or 4 days. And this is a real-time example. This isn't a 10-year or 5-year kind of event. This is happening literally in a month. What's going on in the Turkish lira?
Well, so you're exactly right. Like, so what she's absolutely right too. Like what she's saying about, you know, you have to look over a longer term time horizon. There might be 1 year so that's sort of like a, you know, an aberration or whatever it is. The Turkish lira has been doing this scenario that she's talking about, like this future scenario. It's been doing that since 2018. I remember watching that very closely at the time. This is when I was trading Floor Monkey, but like, It was incredible. I think it was August. It was just incredible to see, like, you know, like 30% in 2 day moves on USDTRY upwards. And so basically what it comes down to is President Erdogan of Turkey is the head of HR, as I used to call him. Now he's just basically the governor of the central bank. And he today reiterated this view that he has that raising interest rates, not only does that not, you know, combat inflation, it causes inflation. Turkey has anywhere from a government-reported 20% CPI to upwards of 50% from other estimates, from third-party estimates. It's just, it's very bad, right? So what we get to do in the West and in sort of like stable currencies, be it, you know, dollar, euro, yen, whatever, we get to debate inflation, whether it's transitory, whether it's not. And yes, like there is inflation, maybe not where I am, but like where you are everywhere else. But you're not at a point where you're seeing your life melt away. Like when you wake up and your entire country, like 15% wiped out of, like, you know, it's denominated value. So that's what Turkey is going through right now. And they're rushing into they're rushing the hell out of the lira, just into anything, really. So that's why, you know, Mana or Decentraland or Avalanche, those are the two top cryptos that they're rushing into, because I think that they're already fully loaded long Bitcoin and Ethereum. They have been since for years now. But the lira is something that everybody needs to pay attention to. If you are an equity investor, if you are a rates or a credit investor, if you are watching central banks, central bank independence, governance, all that kind of thing, just for relative context, if you are obviously an FX trader, and certainly if you're a crypto, involved in the crypto community, you absolutely need the lira directly impacts like all of these assets.
Do you think that's why there was a pop in gold a couple of weeks ago? It was like late last week. We had a really significant rally. Do you think that was more of currency flows coming out of lira? I'm just looking for a place to park, and it was just the obvious kind of place to put money.
So it's very tough to tell. I've been trying to watch like on a day-to-day basis for a long time now. But so when this last year, like, you know, was it about 14 months ago or so, when gold ran up through its 2011 high through 2000 and then upwards, right? That was the CBRT. That was the Central Bank Republic of Turkey buying gold. They basically had used their FX reserves to support the lira, and then they decided to just say, all right, screw it. And then they just started buying gold. They drove gold up. Then they basically did their little side door tightening on, what was it, August 4th or something. It was like a Thursday evening. That was the top tick of gold. And then you see gold crash. So in 2020, Turkey was the largest buyer of gold in the world. Turkey was also in that quarter was the largest seller of gold too. So like, that's very possible. You just need to, you know, buy more than you sold. But they're basically, the central bank is day trading the gold. And so when you see like gold is not participating it with like real rates and inflation and all that, it's because there's a massive central bank out there that is liquidating their gold holdings, and screwing that up. So I think when you would think that gold would rise, that's when you get central banks selling into it, right?
Because they're blocking that natural shift of where gold should go, right? And I've definitely noticed, that's a really great observation. I've definitely noticed that the real rates correlation is done. That hasn't worked in a year and a half. You know, like it marginally works, but like real rates rally like crazy and gold does nothing. Like it's been doing nothing. So that's a really fascinating observation.
It doesn't work when you have the number 10th largest holder of gold liquidating their positions.
Sure.
Like at market. There's a chart basically that I want to illustrate this with. Raoul always talks about like he's like bullish long term on like, you know, the Nasdaq or equities, but not necessarily because he believes that, you know, like equities will rise in value. It's more so kind of like a hedge against a weakening currency or a depreciating currency because of too much, you know, central bank money printing or commercial bank, however you want to phrase it, whatever it is. And the debasement of currency, right? The denominator effect. So this is like a concept I think that some people have a hard time wrapping their heads around. This is actually happening right now in real time. So it's kind of very easy to see. So if you look at this chart, so Brian, it's like chart number one here. This is the BIST 100. So this is the Istanbul, this is the Turkish Stock Exchange, right? This is the S&P of Turkey, if you will. It is on fire, as you can see. It's like the last month, it's up 20-30%. It looks spectacular. Why is that happening? Is it because the Turkish equities are suddenly worth like this breakout, you know, level? Or probably not, right? And the way you could tell is, if you go to chart two, you'll see that TUR is the iShares US-listed, USD-denominated, basically holding the same assets, the same companies, right? It's not really the exact same composition, but it's more or less the same. And you'll see that they are actually up the same percentage that the other one is down. And why did they kind of just split apart like that? Well, if you go to chart three,
currency effects. Yep.
There is. It's the lira just got destroyed, or the USD just rallied against it. And so the actual the Turkish like equities, they're not actually doing anything, but what they're being denominated in is getting weaker, and therefore the prices of those equities goes up. So yeah. This is what he's talking about. This is what you're seeing in real time.
Yeah.
So like Turkey's been on fire, but it's really not in like real USD terms.
Thank you, Weston, for explaining that. Really interesting phenomenon going on. Let's move over to some questions. Andrew M. from the Exchange asks, I'd love to hear an update on Weston about all things Japanese trading, given their own new PM and continuing slowdown in China, and the Fed's posturing to new COVID scare. What are traders doing? What are the housewives doing? What's the outlook here for the Nikkei, yen, and crypto? I mean, you covered a lot of that, but what's your general sense about what's going on in Japan right now?
From a
market standpoint.
Yeah. So retail traders are still Japan has they're sitting on $14 trillion in household cash. Like there's plenty of ammo. They're also sending out checks to 18-year-olds. So like half that's going to go to crypto, half that they're going to spend. there's something that I keep forgetting to bring up too, which is that something very significant, which is that the GPIF, which is the government pension fund, the largest government pension fund in the world, $1.7 trillion in USD in assets. This is not really recently, but I guess maybe like a month ago or so, they officially said that they're not going to follow the FTSE index and have Chinese bonds in their allocation as per their benchmark they're supposed to, but they're going to break with that. I'm talking about Chinese government bonds, right? Like, I'm not even talking about like Chinese credit, And so now that's very interesting because if the largest government pension fund is saying we don't have to buy Chinese bonds, Chinese like sovereign bonds, BlackRock, you don't have to either, or anyone else who says Jake Morgan, whoever it is, who's long and who says like we must be in this, no, you don't have to. So they kind of set this like precedence where it kind of gave an option of like, no, you are choosing to, like, you're not, nobody has a gun to your head. So I think that that's going to, that might reverberate and play out in 2022, yeah, and onwards.
Cool. Next question is from Christopher Y. This one's actually for me. Thank you for keeping Real Vision Exchange Dialogue alive. Intriguing, fantastic platform for brain dump and storm. He's talking about Christopher is talking about the exchange, of course. If you're a Realverse member, hop on. It's a great message board kind of style format where we exchange ideas, talk about markets, etc. Anyway, what do you think about treasuries over the last several weeks? How are you positioned? Your long bond posture? What is your growth outlook? So yeah, I think the fixed income side, especially treasuries, it's just like a ping pong game right now. You got NFP on Friday, NBA mortgage applications on Friday. Wednesday actually, and ISM on Wednesday as well. So these are three really big things for fixed income. I think top line reactions are going to persevere. So you're probably going to get a really strong job number for the last month. But if you keep getting these variant headlines, that's probably going to be a weaker January jobs number. So my kind of gut instinct is like the first reaction is going to be, treasuries falling, and then they might start to find a bid after like a couple days of selling. So I think the risk war is probably still to the upside on the fixed income.
Isn't there a ceiling this week?
Yeah. And by the way, we're running out of money too. So, a couple more questions. Mark from on the Real Vision website asks, thoughts on Twitter as an acquisition candidate now that Jack Dorsey is out? I think that it was probably the smartest decision that Jack Dorsey ever made as CEO of Twitter to leave Twitter, because Square and Cash App are blowing up and he seems really enthusiastic and passionate about the space. And he should honestly concentrate a lot of those efforts there. But Weston, what are your thoughts?
I think you might be referring to that interview with Raoul and Scott Galloway, if that's what he is referring to, which I thought was a pretty interesting idea. Personally, I take that the Jack Dorsey out as Trump will be getting his Twitter account back soon. Seriously.
That's funny.
And he's and like so he doesn't want, you know, he doesn't want to. It's a lose-lose. Like, so he's a part-time CEO. What, you know, like, I don't need this. So, you know.
Griff asks, is Weston doing anything with SoftBank? Any trades you got, Weston?
I'm currently in the middle of moving, and so I have to change my SoftBank, like, Wi-Fi. That's as much as I'm doing with
SoftBank. So are you moving into Ash Bennington's apartment? Is that what's going on?
No, he's been. I've been Airbnb-ing the whole time. You've been seeing him on, like, you know, on RBDB. This is my place. I don't understand what, like what, why is, you know, this is not weird. This is my place. It's weird that he's been there for so long this entire time.
That's great. Well, on that note, I think that's it. Any closing thoughts, Weston? Anything you think we should cover real quick or?
A real comment on SoftBank though. Mm-hmm. SoftBank is. It is like a weird arc, you know. So if you ever find yourself wanting to get arc like exposure, you can do it through SoftBank. But just make sure that there is a buyback behind it. If there is no buyback running, just don't do that. Just buy arc at the highs. If you're going to, but otherwise SoftBank can really rip though. And make sure that when it is ripping, like acknowledge that it's a short cover. If it's going 30% in 2 days, take your profit. That's also about SoftBank. Yeah.
Cool. Weston, thank you for joining us. Thank you everybody for tuning in and we will see you next time.
Really exciting news is we're taking over Las Vegas on December the 9th to the 11th. We're joining forces with MGM themselves at the world-famous MGM Grand, using their venues around Las Vegas itself, some of the best venues in the whole of the city, iconic places, to hold these incredible events. It's going to be all about the biggest revolution since the internet, blockchain. So join us at the Takeover in Las Vegas. I'm going personally. It's the first event I've been to in 21 months. realvision.com/thetakeover. There's some tickets left, or there's a possibility to participate in the online version, the virtual event as well. I'm going to kick it all off with an interview with one of my favorite people in the world, one of the best thinkers, a unique talent, Bill Tai. So join us in Las Vegas for the Takeover. There we go. King of the one takes.